Well, hello, I'm back with Mike, who I talked to yesterday. It's been a while, Mike.
It's been a minute, hasn't it? Literally, a minute.
Yeah, we are recording these back to back, sorry to break the fourth wall and all, but I spoke to Mike about his book yesterday. But of course I have a book, Applied Elite Theory, which is coming out more or less at the same time. I mean, I think this book came out a little bit before yours, right?
Yeah, they
By about a
both came
week.
out in actually yours came out in at the end of October and mine at the end of November. So within about 3 weeks of each other.
Well, I hope it's selling well. I have no idea, you see.
It is doing well, yeah.
Oh, good. Excellent. Excellent. Well, Applied Elite Theory. Hopefully, we'll sell even more copies before Christmas, as well as your book and all the other great books at Imperium Press. Yeah, I had a kind of notion of putting, I knew that Boomer Truth Regime, which is a book that a lot of people want, is, let's just say it's on the back burner for lots of different reasons. Part of the reason is that I still don't know, the story's not finished, right? I still don't know what's going to happen. For example, had I written it last year, I mean, who could have predicted what would happen this year with Tucker Carlson and Fuentes and all the stuff that's happened with Trump? And, it's kind of like the story's not really over when it comes to that particular book, as well as the fact that we happen to have an authoritarian government in Britain at the moment under Keir Starmer, who is extremely unpredictable. I'll just put it that way. So I had the idea of bringing out this, which is essentially a collection of greatest hits, speeches I've given, articles I did on the Substack, articles I did for Chronicle. I have a monthly column with Chronicles magazine called Riding the Tiger. Comes out once a month. I think the one for December is due in a couple of days, and a few other bits and bobs, journal article that I have coming out as well, and a few other things. And putting them basically in a book format where it builds a couple of one, it elaborates on things I couldn't get into in Populist Illusion, things that have come up. Ideology is a big topic. Containment is a big topic, for example. The various debates I've got into, and then there's a whole section on American the political scene in America, which I think is basically a story of Donald Trump succumbing to the iron law of oligarchy from being a genuine threat to the regime to becoming part of it, in a nutshell. And then there's a whole section on the British state of play as well. The never-ending Blair Reich, essentially, which is what we have here. So I wrote to Mike, and then I did, like I've been so busy, Mike. I wrote to you, and you were like, "Yeah, great idea." And then like 6 months went past, and then I came back, and suddenly, finally, we managed to get it together. So I'm pleased that you were able to help me to bring this out.
Yeah, well, when you did approach me with it, it was something where I didn't, you didn't need to twist my rubber arm here. I thought that the idea was great right off the bat. This is something that's very much needed, and it's kind of in some ways a natural evolution. Actually, I wrote the introduction to the book. And I mentioned this in the introduction is that I think that applied elite theory is actually the natural evolution out of populist delusion and prophets of doom. This kind of forms in some ways a trilogy, although I know that there's an intended, there's another volume intended. But this one, we move from theory to history to practice. And I think that that is actually a very natural evolution. And this, so like this book is interesting for a number of reasons. I think it's very much needed because populist delusion has actually done very, very well academically, not just in terms of sales and impact and everything. But if you look it up on Google Scholar, you'll see that it's been cited hundreds of times, right? In the academic
literature. Yep.
You know, it's made an impact. Populist delusion has, absolutely. And I'm sure Prophets of Doom has as well. I haven't looked that one up, but...
less so, unfortunately. But it's been out for... It's had less time to accrue citations, but if you're in university, cite Prophets of Doom as well. Not that I need citations or anything, but yeah, I've noticed a lot of people working on Mosca, Pareto, elite theory, etc. It's become a kind of people are citing it in academic journals and things like that, which is good. Good to see. Yeah. Good to see. Just before we get going, I should say one of my favorite ever exchanges with a publisher. And I've worked with lots of publishers. Mike is my favorite, or one of my favorites, I should say. But one of my favorite exchanges ever, Mike, is I said, remember I was going through that whole phase where I liked 80 synth pop? And I literally just sent Mike saying, I want something that looks like an Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark album cover. And I sent you a couple of album covers. And within a day, you came back to me with this. And I was like, yeah. Let's go with it. Perfect. So I enjoyed that part of the bringing the book out.
Good. You know, we've got some good graphic artists working with us. I can't take credit for that, but
I mean, this one is a great design as well.
Yeah,
the Populist Illusion one. But
I specifically asked for it to be kind of minimalist in that same way, with like good use of space and everything. I think that really fits the vibe. What I was really happy about is that it came, the cover design came back, and it wasn't a copy, wasn't an exact copy of what you sent, but it was the same spirit and everything like that. So, the book, I think overall the package is nice. It, the content is very interesting. Actually, one of the things I find most interesting about the book is that it shows an evolution. It shows the development of your ideas over time, because I mean, it is broken up into three sections. The first section is what were they called? The first section is general theory. The second is American politics, and the third is British politics. I find it interesting that the book called Applied Elite Theory, the first section is general theory. Yeah. But it is actually, I mean, it is very practical and applied even in that section. But within these sections, generally, they are roughly chronological, I think, from memory and how roughly, they're laid out. So you can kind of see a development there from, you know, earlier times to later times in your thinking. Actually, I think
more and more black pills. Time goes on.
More and more black pills. More and more disillusioned with the right as well, which is
disillusioned. Disillusioned, yeah.
So. Yeah. Now, I'm sorry. I to be honest, I don't buy that you're a center leftist. I don't think you are.
Because, I get that a lot. I get that a lot. But
I mean, not to digress into my own ideas, but I think one of the cardinal elements of the right is to have an agentic worldview, a worldview where agency and not structure moves everything. And certainly your worldview in Populist Delusion through Applied Elite Theory is very much agency driven. It is people that drive things and not ideas and not structures. So anyway, that's my own little...
I've not really talked about this, but remember, my background before getting into elite theory was in Austrian, as well as being a Shakespeare scholar, which is all about human agency as well. If you read my stuff on Shakespeare, I'm all about human action or action and agency decisions in Shakespeare. But also I was into Austrian economics, and Ludwig von Mises, his famous book was Human Action, right? And it one of the things that appealed to me about Austrian economics, you know, it has shortcomings, right? And I'm not a libertarian, as people know, but one of the things that really made sense to me was how he axiomatically built on this central foundation that humans act, right? Humans act in the world, and that they have to, like, in order to get anything done, you have to make plans, you have to do stuff. And obviously in Austrian economics, the central agent is the entrepreneur, right? Now, in a way, for a long time, I viewed elite theory really as almost like the economics of politics, or like the, it's like the human action of the political world. Although if you take it seriously, you then kind of realize that there is no economics without politics, and the economic is always already political, which kind of makes a nonsense of libertarianism, right? So, which is how I kind of end up in with a lot of my conclusions now. But yeah, you're right that I do foreground human decisions all the time. And I'm kind of against the notion of you know, the idea that it's things are just emergent, honestly, if Trump has given us anything in the second admin, Trump 2.0, it has been to show us just the extent to which things aren't emergent, and people are just one of the things that's changed is that back in the day, all of these organizations, all of these committees and so on would meet behind closed doors. Now, for some reason, they decide to stream it. I don't know why, but at the moment, you can actually see them conspiring with each other and talking about, you know, oh, the problem of who Tucker Carlson's talking to, and, you know, well, how can we get the minds of the youth back on board and things. I mean, one, if you were that high IQ, you'd do it behind closed doors. you actually would do it behind closed doors. But yeah, I think you're right that I do see agency rather than kind of just inhumane structural forces working. Whether that's a left-right thing, I don't know. But you're right on that, yeah.
Yeah, most definitely. That's something that is a thread that runs through all of your writings. And I think that that is a right-wing thing. I don't know, this isn't really the time or place to win you back over to the right, but I just think that that's that it's,
well,
it's
in, I mean, it's also in the tradition of John Lennon, isn't it? as a kind of well, you know, it's just Yoko and me, and that's reality. I make it. No, I'm only joking.
Yeah, I guess.
why don't we
back to the truth regime,
why don't we get into some of the things? I mean, I don't know how you want to do this, but yeah, maybe we can just go through section by section or something.
We can maybe go through some of the chapters in the first. I think that the ones that are really geared to general discussion are in the first section, the one on general theory. Mm-hmm. The Boomer Truth Regime essay, I read through it. I was thinking of ways in which I disagree with it. And I honestly didn't come up with anything, to be honest. I think it's actually a very good overview of the post 1945 moral narrative, you know, that we all know, anchored in World War II myth making and all of this, these myths that act as unfalsifiable moral imperatives. But it is a good lens through which to look at legitimacy, right? Because it is mythic in its element. And I think that Trump himself is kind of the transitional figure, perhaps away from the Boomer Truth regime, although he doesn't disagree with it in any real way. Mm-hmm. He is sort of in his own way, kind of a myth. Right, in the Sorellian sense, which is actually the Sorellian sense of myth, is something that you discuss in that essay. So,
yes,
that might be worth talking about.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very difficult thing to approach, because quickly, when it comes to this topic, you get into historical revisionism, right? And at the moment, that's been, you know, you've got Darryl Cooper and all these sorts of figures, you know, poking holes at the narrative of Winston Churchill and, you know, was the legacy of Hitler and all of that sort of stuff. And in a way, that stuff is interesting, but it's less important than the cartoon myth version of all it. Like in a what I was trying to stress in that essay is, in a way, the Hollywood version of it is just more important. And I remember when I was reading, do you remember in the Nuremberg trials, they presented some shrunken heads as evidence? Are you aware of this?
No.
Right, they basically said that the Nazis in one of the death camps or whatever were shrinking heads, right? Like was it African tribes used to do the shrunken heads, right? So and they presented this as evidence at, you know, at the Nuremberg trials. And years later I watched this Ripley's Believe It or Not on this, and they were like, oh yeah, this wasn't real. And I am unclear as to what the current status of the shrunken heads is, i.e. do people accept it as real evidence, or do they say it was a hoax or whatever? I don't really. Point is, I found an essay written in the 1990s by somebody saying, look, it doesn't actually matter if they did this or not, because the more important thing to get across to people is that people who were ostensibly civilized, the Germans, were capable of devolving to this level of barbarity, and that this is the thing, the thing that is symbolized in this evidence at Nuremberg, and that's the important thing, right? I.e., the actual truth of the matter is neither here nor there. It truly is the myth. You understand what I'm saying?
Oh, absolutely. Yep. Yeah, and that's the whole thing about the Sorellian myth, is that the facts on the ground are less important than the motivating force that the myth has. The myth is ultimately something that is there to galvanize you, to get you to do something. This form of myth, we're not talking about the myths of Zeus and Europa or anything like that. We're talking about, you know, the myth of the Boomer Truth regime, or the myth of communist utopia, or something like that, like those kind of myths. Those kind of myths are not there to describe the world. They're ultimately there to prescribe action. And this is exactly what you've described there in the Nuremberg trials, right? Because what it's essentially telling you to do is to orient yourself toward the world in a certain way, to view the world in a certain way. It's telling you that, you know, this kind of barbarism is always just latent below the surface. And if you don't stamp it out at the barest whiff of anything like that, then anything like this kind of intolerance or what have you, then it will flare up like a forest fire in no time. So you basically have to be hyper vigilant. It's not sort of telling you, like, the descriptive fact in the world is worth less than the prescriptive command to be vigilant, right? That's essentially what it's telling you, is to be vigilant.
Absolutely. And in a way, that's what the Boomer Truth regime is. You know, I talk about John Lennon and Winston Churchill side by side. Churchill is the vigilance, the hypervigilance to protect the John Lennon. Does that make sense? So, I mean, again, the real life Churchill probably would have thought John Lennon was an idiot or something, right? He probably wouldn't have had any time for John Lennon or his vision or the song Imagine. But the Boomer Truth regime sets it up in such a way that any step away from John Lennon is Hitler, therefore you must embody Churchill. And in a way, it becomes our left and right, where the left is John Lennon and the right is the always Churchill protecting John Lennon. And that's basically still our political left and right, I would argue.
It is, because the political right today essentially views itself as the adults in the room and the left as sort of petulant children that, you know, it is there to protect, or, you know, to create a world within which that can exist, but doesn't ever go too far. And that's actually not that far really from the truth, because, you know, from the archetypal world of Lenin and Churchill, because even though Churchill probably wouldn't have had the time of day for Lenin, he certainly would have had the time of day for the possibility of Lenin, right? Like he was there basically to protect the freedom that Lenin embodied, or the freedom that Lenin then saw to its conclusion or whatever, what have you, right? So the two are actually, you know, sort of tied at the hip. I think that those actually viewing them as the left and the right are, that's a good way of looking at it, because as we now know, and as has been, I mean, I even cited in my Culture Thug Handbook a study or a paper that was put forth by Ziblatt and Gidron, which they basically said that, you know, the real bulwark of liberalism is the center right. That is the protector. Once that goes, the whole structure collapses. So if that center right is Churchill and the radical left is Lenin, then that's, you know, that framework makes perfect sense within the frame of actual hard political science.
One of the reasons I'm not able to finish this book, among several reasons, is that at the moment, if Boomer Truth regime was a bucket, it'd be full of holes and it's losing water at a rapid rate of knots, right? Trouble is, I don't know where that's going at the moment. And while it's in flux, it's a bit difficult to... I mean, you know, in ideal circumstances, I'll be able to finish the book as a eulogy to Boomer Truth, where I'm almost writing about something that happened 500 years ago, you know what I mean? But at the moment, it's kind of lashing wildly. And there are these... In a way, it's a shame it's happened, because it's all become very explicit and quite tiresome. And I don't really want to be part of those debates, you know, like the Darrell Cooper or, you know, various other people Tucker Carlson has had on, and now Niall Ferguson has to get involved, and oh, what about this historian? Do you know what I mean? I don't want to have that debate at all. Do you know what I mean? I want to talk about, in a way, I want to talk about it almost like Michel Foucault was talking about the Renaissance or something. Do you know what I mean? So, anyway. Yeah. What else have we got in this?
Actually segues nicely to one of the other essays, which is In Search of a Political Formula. I think it's the fourth essay, perhaps, in that first section. Because if the political formula is not, you know, John Lennon saying, I don't believe in any of this stuff, it's I believe in me. Well, if that's not the political formula anymore, what is? And in this essay, you consider and analyze a number of potential political formulas that could replace that, right? One of them being return to tradition, another one being stop the great replacement, another one being Christ is king, and another one being clear them out. I think that's all of them, but I could be missing one. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the old Cold War formula of Boomer Truth is collapsed, and the new DEI creed has absolutely
America first. Is another one.
Sorry?
America first is another one. Yeah.
Ah, yes, that's right. That's right. Yeah. I think that one is sort of a milder form of return to tradition. It's probably why I forgot it, but DEI is falling flat. Nobody believes in it. Nobody ever really believed in it. It was propped up by USAID money and ESG bucks. That was it. So what? There is no unifying principle anymore. The Boomer Truth principle is strong in that generation, but Zoomers don't believe in it. They don't care about World War II. So what is the new unifying principle? We better figure it out. There's going to be a legitimacy crisis, and that's kind of what's happening today, right? So I think this is interesting because I have some sympathy to some of these political formulas and less to others. But do you want to talk about those formulas a little bit?
Well, I mean, I essentially have problems with all of them and explain why I don't think they're a goer, somewhat controversially, which means it's not that I'm necessarily against, right? But I just... Again, with a realist hat on, I'm saying, could these feasibly work going forward? And I can't even remember what my reasons were now, but I mean, America first. One of the important things to mention is that no political formula can brook an end, right? you cannot have America first and, you know, Israel first or something. Okay. And, I would say the problem with America first is that as we're actually seeing through, the second Trump admin is that it can kind of be it doesn't really mean anything. It can be redefined. I mean, at the moment, they're trying to sell America first as this kind of neo-imperial thing. Before, it was an isolationist policy. Now it's peace through strength. Do you know what I mean? It's like, so the definition of what America first means is slippery. It keeps on changing all the time. Now, obviously, there's Schmidt who interprets, right? But yeah, there's a bit of an issue with that. The second thing, of course, is that, I mean, through my analysis, the preservation of America can only ever really be the preservation of liberalism. So, from my stance, it's like, well, what are you actually trying to, like, by saying America first, what are you actually trying to preserve ultimately? So,
well, America first as a political formula or as a myth is a terrible imperial myth. It's basically screw you provinces. I don't think that's really, because, like, you know, if you think of the myth of Rome, like, what was it that actually, what was Rome's myth? Well, I mean, straightforwardly, it was Livy's myth of the foundation of Rome by Romulus. But beyond that, I mean, what differentiated Rome and the reason why it was able to rise as a power in the time that it did essentially is because it was quite happy to invite other provincial powers to have a place at its hearth. It was basically it was willing to invite them in and be like, okay, well, you're not Roman, but you at least have a seat at the table. Right. And I think America first is kind of pushing back against that. It's more of a centripetal force that keeps the provinces at bay. So it's a terrible imperial formula, in my estimation. It's a good isolationist formula, and maybe that's the direction that America needs to go. But yeah, I agree with you when you say that America is fundamentally built on the Enlightenment and liberalism, and I just don't see either of those things as having any legs at all anymore. I think they're part of the problem. They're not really the solution. So I would set that one aside. Return to tradition. That's an interesting one. That's an interesting one for me. Because from memory, what you were saying in that, your criticism of that formula is that we are the children of winter. And for us to return to a springtime ethos, to return to a springtime worldview, is kind of not to live in reality. It's kind of, you know, to LARP, frankly, to live some other civilization's life. And I think that as far as it goes, that's actually a valid critique, is that we really can't pretend that we are the barbarians, you know, striding out of the migration era, this volcanic energy and dream heavy and all of that. Like, that's, we're just not that. So that formulation of return to tradition, which is, I think, the main formulation of it, is not right. It doesn't really make sense. But one of the things that I said in my other book is that we are the children of winter, but the children of winter become the fathers of spring. So I think that there is an interpretation of return to tradition that allows us to basically say, okay, well, we can't go back, but we can plant seeds. We can plant the seeds of what is to come. And you can see how, you know, perhaps with what I've been saying in terms of tribal future, that might be something I'm leaning towards. Now, this is not quite what Evola is saying when he says return to tradition, or, you know, what the capital T traditionists are saying. But I think it is it's an interpretation that at least makes sense in our time.
Yeah, I mean, there was a slight. I mean, I'm trying to think back of what I was thinking of when I wrote this. This is a good few, about 4 or 5 years old now. This one, if you remember, I had my vision of Trump done, Mike, right? My famous positive vision of Trump done, my little town with a windmill and so on. And when I presented that, I said, look, you get to live in Trump done, but I'm going to have to confiscate your mobile phone. And everybody went correct. Everybody was like, no, you're not going to. You are basically Stalin for trying to want to take my mobile phone. People basically flipped out at the notion that I would take their smartphone from them in exchange for returning to paradise. And to me, that showed me that deep down in their reveal preference, people do not actually wish to return to tradition. They may think they do, but they're not willing to give up their smartphone. And until I can see that people are willing to do that, I just don't think it's a go. I think people, once you, it's like Adam and Eve leaving Eden, right? They can't go back. Once you're out of paradise, you can't go back in. And this is the basic issue that I'm trying to get at here. It's like, well, and maybe you're right that you could be the father or the four, you know, the grandchild, the grandfather or something that might come one day. But it strikes me that as soon as you're on one of those screens, it's already lost. Even my five-year-old, she's playing this game Fields of Mystria on my Steam Deck. Maybe it's already over for her. She's already had a taste of modernity, Mike.
Yeah. I mean, this is even a problem in the pagan sphere, right? A sphere which wants to return to tradition so hard that it wants to go back to the tradition before the last tradition, right? Mm-hmm. Even so, I mean, you know, one of the things that is being called for is to re-enchant the world, to go back to a kind of pre-Enlightenment worldview where the world is populated by mystery and intelligences and everything like that. But it's my view that now this is a world that in some ways I actually inhabit because I'm a weird person and I believe in this stuff, but it's not for everybody. This is a world that would be a terrifying world for most people. It's a world of instability and things beyond your ken and beyond your control that are perhaps malevolent. And in any case, I mean, whether you believe in them or not, to live in that world I think most people, if they were thrust into that pre-modern world, would beg to go back. So I see exactly what you're saying.
But also, like, even a little bit more fascinating, like whenever Tucker Carlson mentions demons, for example, right? This is shown as evidence that he's mad, or the evidence that, yeah, well, how can you take him seriously? And the people who do that mocking are exactly those people who've read Bronze Age Mindset and, you know, write in, what's that magazine called? The one that loves the esoteric Trump. I forget what it's called now. Man's World, Reenchant the World and all this. But Tucker Carlson talking about demons, well, that's a step too far.
Yeah.
Right, do you know what I mean? So it's like, okay, there's a gap here between what people say and then what actually happens when they're confronted with any even tiny step towards that way of thinking or that way of being, you know? So, I mean, in the end, I came down in that speech on the side of clear them out. And I guess one of the things that happens is that we've seen just how difficult that is, right? Just how far, I mean, even with all the things that have happened in the past 5-10 years, the power structure is pretty entrenched, right? And so I guess, like, you know, okay, it could be a good unifying formula in, you know, in the here and now to wish to clear them out. But by clear them out, I mean have a circulation of the elites and a change, you know, a change of the current elites with who are enemies by replacing them with friends. As time has gone on, that has looked more kind of less and less likely, less and less obvious. As it becomes, how can I put it? As it becomes evident that we're looking like trying to find a good one. Trying to find an R guy, who someone who's not corrupted, seems to be impossible. right? But all the hope that people had in Donald Trump, utterly corrupted. All of the people around him, utterly corrupted. In our politics, you know, whether it's Farage or one of these other people, utterly corrupted. It'll, you know, if it's not the Israel thing, it'll be some other thing. Oh, by the way, he's a pedo. Oh, brilliant. Do you know what I mean? So it feels like every time there's a bit of hope, it ends up being false hope. And you know, over time, it makes you, or it's at least in the here and now, in the short term, I no longer see clear them out as viable. So for a long time, I've kind of been in the world of second, third, fifth best, which is, I hate to say it, Mike, competent containment is the best we can hope for. So in a lot of the stuff I've argued in this book, it's like, well, clear them out's not possible. So what's the next best thing we can hope for? Competent containment. So, you know, maybe Trump could have been competent containment. That's not happened. That's not happened either. Maybe right. Keir Starmer, maybe Labour can be competent containment. That's not happened either. Seems to be beyond them. So even the fifth best option, the 10th best option, which is keep the current people in power, but at least have them pretend to sort out the problems to make people a little bit happier in the short term. They can't even do that. Anyway, carry on.
Yeah. I think there's also maybe a little bit of a tension, even just conceptually, with Clear Them Out and Michel's idea of iron law of oligarchy. Because who says... Yeah. Who says organization says oligarchy, right? And the fact is that the regime is orders of magnitude better organized than any insurgency that could possibly clear them out. Like, you know, to clear them out, you need to overcome coordination problems. You need patronage networks. You need to deal with the retaliation of the security state. And then once you're in power, you need to deal with the fallout from, you know, retaliation internationally and all of that. I mean, it's a tall order. It's a very, very tall order. Yeah. So I can understand the pessimism of this idea of, you know, infiltrating the apparatus, the state apparatus, mm-hmm. which is why for solutions, I tend to look more towards the structural issues that the regime faces and that I don't think they're going to be able to solve. I think that this is essentially going to cause problems where they're simply not going to be able to govern at the scale that they have been. But anyway, that's to go beyond the scope of applied elite theory. Yeah, I think that this is an issue. And looking at these things in terms of agency, in terms of, like, it's men who move and will that moves history and not structure, not, you know, spontaneous emergent orders. This is sort of the province of the right. It reminds me, actually, I had a conversation with Greg Johnson a few years ago. I think we were talking about Sorrell, actually. And he asked me, you know, who is our Marx? And we kind of hit upon Vico. Vico mm-hmm. is perhaps the closest that we have to Marx. But now thinking about it some years later, I don't think a Marx is really possible for the right in the basis of this agentic paradigm. Because what Marx wants to say is that it's the material conditions that move history. He wants to say that it's the structure that's doing all the heavy lifting. And I just don't think that is our worldview. I just don't think it is, right? I think something like elite theory is much closer to, you know, our thing, basically. This is why we like it and why the left doesn't really want to own it. The best you're going to get is a kind of, you know, Lenin was obviously an elite theorist, but he would never admit to it. Blair is obviously an elite theorist, but he would never admit to that either, right? He's not going to come out and say, well, have you considered Schmidt or, you know, Moscow or anything? I think that this worldview that men and, you know, the great man of history worldview fits very much more within this elite framework, but it also brings some paralysis in terms of, like, what are we actually supposed to do with it? So this is why I think that the book is actually really, really useful, is that it gives you hard case studies of like, what does it actually look like when you apply Mosca's law or the iron law of oligarchy or Pareto's framework of residues and derivations? Like, how does that actually work when you apply it to reality? And so, you know, it's very interesting to see that worked out in these case studies.
Yeah. I'm just now having a look to see if there's any interesting ones to pick out. I mean, there's a whole section here where I was in debates with various different people. Keith Woods was one of them. James Lindsay was another one. Where I talked about ideology and what I call the James Lindsay Debate Club theory of history. And I kind of try to flesh out what ideology actually is. With the formula BS, 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 therefore I rule. Okay. I still don't really know why so many people took exception to that, because pretty much that is what Pareto is saying, and pretty much that is what happened. And I remember that you were involved in some of those debates at the time, when it was a few years ago now. But I still kind of stand by the basic idea that in order for an ideology to be an ideology, it has to be backed by power, and it kind of has to find itself in action. There's no like liberal democracy in the abstract. It is what liberal democracy has done. That's why I insist, for example, that there was a real socialism in the Soviet Union, and it was the one under Stalin, because that was the applied lived one. Or that, you know, fascism is whatever Mussolini decided. Doesn't really matter what Gentile said in his books or whatever. The actual decisions and actions that were made was the ideology working itself out in reality. Does that make sense? So that still remains controversial, but it's one of the harder theses that I stand by. And it's one of the ones that I think is borne out repeatedly by actual, like, real life. I think one of the debates that was going on at the time, for example, was whether whether there was enough flexibility in the elite to, you know, bend a little bit on some of the woke stuff. And I think they've shown that when push comes to shove, they're prepared to do what it takes to stay in power, to say what is necessary, and to kind of change these formulas on the fly a little bit, because it's justifying, you know, I mean, just in the past year, we got Keir Starmer talking about the islands of strangers. He was the Labour Prime Minister. So
yeah,
that was one of the, yeah. Go on, Mike.
Yeah, I remember those debates that were going on at that time, of like, you know, realism versus idealism. I wrote a Substack article called Realism versus Idealism that was sort of responding to that back in the day. And I mean, I think that this idea that it's ideals that drive history, and, you know, the James Lindsay debate club view of the world, where it's really just a big sort of, you know, debate, and the history of ideas is where the ideas are moving things and the men are inspired by the ideals, and then they, you know, take them up and they defend them, and it's this kind of heroic, it is a noble vision. I won't deny that, like, it has its attractiveness to it, but it's, I think, fundamentally a left-wing worldview that sees things that way. It's really men that move history, and it's will, it's people who are willing to essentially take, you know, the world by the scruff of the neck and make it according to their will, right? And I framed it at the time in terms of the Odinic versus the Tyric. Without really going too far into it, we could sort of just say that's, you know, the great man of history view versus the traditionalist or continuator of order view, right? And I think this is a better framework to look at than left versus right, because it's more it's more perennial, it's more universal. There really isn't a left and right, not really a left and right in, like, you know, Greek history or, you know, ancient Russian history or whatever, but there is certainly this great man versus continuator of order. And really what the great man does is he is the one that turns everything upside down and makes the world in his own image. And it's who follows him that is stamps it with the, you know, it gives it the stamp of tradition and legitimacy and the continuation. And now this is ours. It's not just something that this terrifying, you know, Odinic figure come out of the wilderness has done. It's now our thing, right? And realism is that. Realism is Peter the Great, right, who has come and remade Russia in his own image. And idealism is really Tsar Alexei from 50 years later or 100 years later, whatever it was, who is there basically to say, Peter the Great got everything right, and now this is what Russian society is about. You know, I think idealism doesn't come first, and to put it first is really to put the cart before the horse. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, I came down on that the same side as I think I was more in your camp on that. I mean, but it's they are in some ways kind of entangled, right? Because realism shapes idealism. Because idealism enshrines the morality of the realist. So they are actually, you know, they're not completely separate, but they are kind of synthesized in that framework, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, to me, just to give a really simple example, right? Did the leaders of the British Empire suddenly get drunk on the idea of laissez-faire and free trade? No, they didn't. They wanted to expand the remit of their power, and they wanted to, because they were the largest power in the world, they wanted to pull smaller powers into their region of influence and control, okay, by enmeshing them in trade relationships. So when Britain was the biggest power, it basically was advantageous to push free trade as a doctrine, to push other powers into their networks. Also, if you're controlling colonies around the world, division of labor and Ricardo's comparative advantage. Okay, you could say, well, okay, you're gonna process cocoa plants in Ghana, and we're gonna make chocolate bars, and this is a good division of labor for comparative advantage, and we all win. These are all just very convenient justifications for doing what the British Empire did. When circumstances changed, all of a sudden they rediscovered protectionism and List and, yeah, you know, Keynes and all the rest of it. Well, now we're not for free trade anymore. Same thing with the American Empire. So you can see, it's like, okay, well, is it that everybody got their head full of Adam Smith, or is it that they needed a justification so they they looked on the shelf and found Adam Smith or Milton Friedman or whoever it is. You understand what I mean? So it strikes me that it's always justifying something that they already want to do. One of my favorite articles ever, Mike, is in The Spectator. You can pull this up because it's really funny. It's called In Defense of Blairism by Tony Blair.
Right, I've seen that before.
That is a perfect encapsulation. What is Blairism? It's what Tony Blair does. So anyway, last one on this little section, I do want to touch on are these two more recent articles. I think they're from last year. One called Tuning Out the Clown Show, which is a talk I gave at the last, at the WITAN, not this year, but the one last year, and an article called The Online Right is Almost Entirely Fake. Those two do get at some of my disillusionment, but also they I think they get at something quite serious that we may have been less aware of maybe 4, 5, 6 years ago, which is that these spaces, the online space where ideas are generated and so on, became of interest to power networks in and of themselves. And they then sought to influence those spaces, infiltrate those spaces, pay off various people within those spaces. And suddenly you're like, oh, hold on a second. Well, there are lots of people here. And now it's become a bit of a meme. Now it's like, I mean, since it's become so explicit with Israel and you're being paid 7K and all that sort of stuff, it's a lot more obvious. But back then I was trying to get at the fact that not everything is as it seems. Not all voices in these spaces are truly independent, or they're not like, you know, they present themselves as friends, but actually they're secretly working for some oligarch or something like that. That is what I was trying to get at in that. And also at the same time, how really a lot of that discourse, the clown show, as I call it, is a surrogate activity in lieu of actual politics. As you know, Uncle Ted would call it a surrogate activity, a form of entertainment. You know, and here I'm talking about the, it's like the Candice Owens, right? Or the who's your favorite YouTuber feuding with today type thing. This is not actually politics, let's face it. That's not politics. So yeah, that's where I was really getting at there. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, I do. Actually, I'd like to start with the online right is almost entirely fake article, and then we'll move to the clown show one. This was written earlier this year on your Substack, so it's not that old. It is really a scathing denunciation of the online right, which is, it's fair, right? Because so much of it has been bought and co-opted and click chasing and serving donors and all of that. It's just turned the system. This is what liberalism does. It assimilates everything that is remotely digestible to it into a monetized spectacle and essentially defangs it. That's what it has tried to do. Jonathan Bowden many years ago said that there were two things that are totally indigestible to liberalism. One of those is religious fundamentalism, and the other one is the radical right. Now, it seems like he might have underestimated to some degree the ability of liberalism to co-opt the latter in the same way that the communists wildly underestimated liberalism's ability to assimilate radical left-wing politics from the 19th century. I think that's completely assimilated now, right? Just look at all the Che Guevara, merch that you can get anywhere now. But still, I think I would like to leave the reader or the listener with, you know, the sense that there are spaces of authenticity in the online right. Maybe I'm just stuck in one of those nodes of authenticity, but I can certainly see some genuine actors from where I'm sitting. One of the things that is a bit of a encouragement to me is Substack. I think Substack is looking pretty good still. It's starting to become it's starting to become a little bit crowded, for lack of a better term, I think. Mm-hmm. And some of it, I think, is going in directions that are useless. But still, I think it's actually quite authentic, and there's not if you go on Substack, you certainly get a sense that it's not nearly as fake as many of the other platforms. But yeah, the fact is that it is the online right is mostly fake. I don't deny that.
I also think it's worth being a bit explicit here is that some of these people maybe aren't working for liberalism per se, but are simply just working for Israel. right? And I don't think the Zionists particularly care about liberalism. In fact, they see it as a problem in many ways because the liberal order is against them. So as a strategy, is they have a strategy really of kind of, well, if we can get into these spaces, at the very least, we can get these guys on board with Israel, you know, and then, you know, the quid pro quo is they get to be racist and call people brown or whatever, you know.
Well, I would say, though, that liberalism, you know, if you look at it from the framework of Schmitt's, what's that book about parliamentary politics?
He sees
liberalism as essentially a form of minoritarianism. And I think that's a natural fit for those people. And so I think for them to lose that and to creep into a majoritarian, some sort of like, you know, actual democracy, if that could ever exist, or, you know, some strongman fascistic politics, that's the danger zone for them. I think that they're right to tread carefully with that stuff.
Yes. All right. Well, and that's pretty much it for the first section. I don't know if you want to get into any of the others, but we've been an hour. Any other bits you want to pick up on, Mike, before we...
One thing I just wanted to say a little bit about the Tuning Out the Clown show, and then maybe we can draw it to a close, because there's just so much in this book that we could talk about it for 3 hours. But the culture war thing, I think, actually is, as much as it's a distraction, it's also a bit of a danger for... I don't think the regime wants the culture wars. I think it's a concession. I think it's something that they have to allow, basically. Because what it does is, in my view, it primes the man in the street for conflict. And I think that... are you familiar with Paul Scalise on Twitter? He goes by the handle Lindy Man.
I have come across him.
One of our authors pointed out to me, I read a thread by him a week or so ago on the return of oral culture, because of course, as we both know, sadly, literacy is declining precipitously. We are moving into a new kind of oral culture, and I think he's hit upon this, and I agree with him. If you look at the eternal Zoomer, you know, what are the formats that the Zoomer likes to consume? It's not so much long form books. It's not even like long form video essays. You know, on YouTube, what's popular now? Well, what's popular is things like live streams and AMAs and reaction videos. And all, like, you could go through a dozen of these, you know, emergent genres, and ultimately what these all are is a form of oral culture, right? Like the podcast is nothing to do with the written word, it's oral, right? And there are systemic reasons why I think the internet is moving us towards this oral culture. And one of the aspects of oral culture that's the most important is the agonistic world, right? It's the world of contention and fighting. You know, people love a good fight online. People love drama. They love to see people screaming at each other on these like 3-hour live streams. And this is a world primed for reaction. And ultimately, I think audiences are building... Now, this is, of course, it's very far removed and abstracted from actual violence, but audiences are kind of developing a taste for blood. I think, you know, we're kind of starting to see the return of friend enemy politics in this return of the oral culture. I mean, just like, what was it that people liked about Trump? I mean, they liked what he had to say about tariffs, and they liked what he had to say about, like, you know, like ending forever wars in the Middle East. But really what they liked is they liked that he could take a big steaming dump on Republicans, that he was able to trounce them in these debates. So, you know, this, the culture wars and this clown show of politics, these outrage cycles that don't really change anything. Now, they don't change the political landscape in per se, But I think what they do is they move culture toward this more agonistic, antagonistic, culture of conflict. And actually, I think that is kind of dangerous. I think that's something that the regime would put away if it could.
Well, what one thing I'll say is that, I mean, I'm not sure, because what I've really got in mind is Piers Morgan, right? If you ever go on Piers Morgan's channel and have a look at his thumbnails, right? It's basically like a lineup of people just shouting at each other. You know, like Candy Sewing shouting at Rabbi Shmuley or whatever, okay?
Yeah.
Or whatever it is, okay? Some transsexual shouting at some conservative or whatever. But the point I was trying to make was that a nuclear bomb could go off, and if the net result was Piers Morgan shouting at Candice Owens the next day, kind of like, is the system's all right with that? What is interesting is that when I wrote that, the Tuning Out the Clown Show, which was last year now, I don't think I could have foreseen where that sort of Piers Morgan discourse has gone, the clown show, where it's prepared to go. And I've been a little bit surprised, I have to admit, with where, like, the topics and the guests that he in particular has been prepared to, like, the debates he's been prepared to have. Like, some of the guests he's had on, Mike, have got into very spicy territory. Especially as the, you know, discourse around Israel and so on, I've been surprised by how much of that has been allowed, quote unquote, or why it has been. I have theories about it. But I do agree with you that it does, there is a danger there in general, where the combative nature can actually produce like real friend enemy. And I guess, you know, at that time, the Charlie Kirk thing had not happened either.
Things have really accelerated, even in the last half a year, even the last 3 months, to be honest. And, these outrage cycles have to continue to escalate, because if they don't, people tune out, right? So there's a kind of incentive structure there that, like, you know, conflict needs to continually get ratcheted up and up and up. So I'm actually not surprised. I haven't seen any of these Piers Morgan episodes, but, you know,
well, I suppose it's like porn. It's like porn, right? You can't just, like, it keeps on escalating until people have to, like, watch, like, I don't know, whatever, like, disgusting fetishes or whatever, because how are you going to get your kick out of the way? It has to keep on going somewhere. And in a way, this is what Piers Morgan has done, where it's like, okay, we've done that now. We've talked about that. Where else can we go? You know, and he's gone, like, I mean, I remember one, he had this guy on called Dan Blazarian or something. And they just, like, did full out, like, the whole Holocaust denial thing. I was like, wow, okay, Piers Morgan's doing Holocaust denial now. Right, okay. And that's on YouTube with millions of people watching it. That would never, I mean, even 2 years ago, that wouldn't have happened. You know what I mean? So anyway.
Yeah. When I look at the clown show of 2025 versus the political theater of 1985, I mean, there's no comparison between those two. And I think that containment really requires a narrow Overton window. The more narrow, the better, the more contained it can be. And unfortunately for the powers that be, the internet has blown that window wide open. So this actually is a good thing, I think, because makes it very hard for them to govern. So that's a good thing as far as I'm concerned.
All right, Mike. Well, interesting. I mean, I guess the flip side of it is, if 2 million people are watching Piers Morgan, what they're not doing is organizing. From a purely point of view, they would be like, well, yeah, but you know, 2 million are you watching Piers Morgan, another 3 million are watching Tucker, another 6 million are watching Candice Owens. What they with their popcorn, what they're not doing is doing any actual politics or organizing. So, in a way, it's like, well, you've replaced the function of what Hollywood and TV used to do, only with the strange thing that all the content they're consuming is radicalizing too.
I mean, it's true. Like the analogy is the same as the pornography analogy, where, you know, that's all fine as long as the bits keep flowing. But like, you know, what happens if somebody, somebody turns that spigot off? Then all of a sudden you've got a whole bunch of pent up frustration, and that could be easily mobilizable into something. So really what it requires is just continual management and continual bureaucratic control. And the question is, will that continue? And that's the open question, I suppose.
All right, Mike. Well, it's been interesting. People can buy Applied Elite Theory on Imperium Press site. Is there on? I think they can get on Amazon as well. But yeah, you get more money. We get more money if it's through IP, right? So.
Yeah, but leave a review on Amazon because that helps us too.
Yeah, 5-star ones. All right, thank you very much, Mike. I won't take up any more of your time. Hope to speak soon. If I don't see you, have a good Christmas, because we're in December now. And I'll catch you around.
Thanks for having me on again.
If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just 3 of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.